This is Ocean Robbins welcoming you to Day 3 in the Food Revolution Summit. On the first day of our summit, we weathered a highly sophisticated cyber attack. Our security team is telling us that it was the kind of attack that is not intended to steal data, but rather to destroy our site and shut us down. I'm glad to say that the attack failed. I want to apologize again if you experienced any inconvenience accessing our broadcast on that day, and also for the few remaining glitches that took place in our broadcast yesterday. The good news is that our added security measures are working, and much more importantly, the food revolution is alive and well. I want to thank you, and I want to thank all of our more than 100,000 participants for hanging in there with us. Your participation in this summit means a lot to me, to my dad, to our whole team, and to the work that we're here to do together. Today's topic is your food safe? The truth about GMOs and pesticides. In a few moments, you're going to hear my dad and colleague, John Robbins, interview public interest attorney and Center for Food Safety founder, Andrew Kimbrell. In an hour, you'll hear from Consumers Union senior scientist, Dr. Michael Hansen. And at the top of the hour after that, you'll hear from Environmental Working Group founder and president, Ken Cook. After each presentation, you'll hear a pre-recorded testimonial and music before the next presentation starts on the hour. If you're listening on our website and at any point your sound cuts out, please try refreshing the page. Here we go. Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Andrew Kimbrell. Andrew Kimbrell is a public interest attorney and the founder and director of the 400,000-member Center for Food Safety. Andrew is a leader in the fight to protect people and the environment from the threats of chemical-dependent industrialized agriculture. His most recent book is Your Right to Know, Genetic Engineering and the Secret Changes in Your Food. Andrew has been called upon to testify before Congress, and his work has been featured in dozens of published works and documentaries. So now, Andrew, my dad and I are so grateful that we get to have this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Andy, for being with us again. I always love having your wisdom and your knowledge and your passion in our summits and spread far and wide because they are such a contribution to our world.
Well, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be back here, and thank you both for what you do. This is really great. Getting this information out is so critical, and you do such a fabulous job at it. So it's certainly right back at you. Thank you for what you do.
Well, thank you. And I want to start asking you about corn. It's an enormous crop in this country. It's grown for ethanol. It's grown for livestock feed. It's grown for high fructose corn syrup and other sweeteners. Very little of it is growing for sweet corn on the cob. And a very high percentage of the corn that's grown in the country today is genetically engineered. And it's engineered by Monsanto to produce an insecticide known as BT in every cell of the plant. A couple years ago, a Canadian study found 93% of blood samples taken from pregnant women and 80% of samples taken from umbilical cords tested positive for the BT toxin. Monsanto says it doesn't matter if the BT toxin is turning up in people's blood because they say the BT toxin is natural. What's the truth, Andy? Can we rest comfortably with the idea that BT toxin in human blood is harmless?
Certainly not. This is remarkable. You know, you have to sort of take a step back and say, well, goodness, this genetically engineered corn, and by the way, it's stacked not only with this BT, which is the pesticidal DNA that is in the corn, but it's also, this corn has been genetically engineered to make it resistant, so it can withstand massive dosings of Monsanto's Roundup. So it's stacked with two traits, and often even more than that, all in that poor little corn seed. But no, BT is a toxin. Again, introduced in 1997. Here we are in 2014, and we still do not have our government or Monsanto or any major scientific organization that's gone and really looked at this. It's independent scientists have found the findings that you just said, John. It's clearly concerning. We don't like to see that kind of a toxin, certainly not passing into fetuses. It's something we need to investigate. It's a serious question about these crops that has not been answered. And these are the kind of questions that should have been answered before these crops, were allowed to be planted, before these foods were allowed to be on our shelves. And we are now something like, 17 years in, and those questions still have not been answered. And if it weren't for these independent scientists at these universities who are doing these studies, and by the way, they're often attacked, they're often persecuted, trying to get rid of their tenure. These are very courageous scientists quite often who come up with these independent findings. But the real scandal is with the FDA. The real scandal is with these corporations that have not done their homework to prove that these toxic plants are safe.
Speaking of scandals, I want to ask you about alfalfa. It's a huge crop. It's the fourth most widely grown crop in the country, behind corn and soybeans and wheat. It's the primary feedstock for the dairy industry. It's grown on more than 17 million acres in the United States, which almost approximates all of our fruit and vegetable acreage combined. And up until very recently, almost all, maybe 90% of the alfalfa planted by farmers in the United States was grown without the use of any herbicide. But now Monsanto has genetically engineered and gotten approval for a variety of alfalfa that is, as you mentioned earlier with the corn, able to withstand repeated applications of glyphosate, the active ingredient in Monsanto's herbicide Roundup. Due to the planting of Monsanto's genetically engineered alfalfa, the USDA estimates 23 million more pounds of toxic herbicides will be released into the environment each year. You've been deeply involved in this battle over GMO alfalfa from the very beginning and continue to be to this day. Why did the USDA ignore the very environmental and economic harms their own report predicted would occur and approve genetically engineered alfalfa?
Well, that's the question of the day, John. We just filed a lawsuit about 3 weeks ago saying to the USDA, we have asked you repeatedly for your reasoning. Why did you correctly state that there was going to be 23 million more pounds of your toxic herbicide being sprayed because of the use of this genetically engineered alfalfa? You said in your environmental impact statement that this would impact numerous endangered species. You said it would contaminate organic and conventional growers who then could not sell their crop overseas. All of this you admitted. You said you would take precautions to not have that, have it grown in areas where it would not contaminate others, take other various precautions. The USDA did not do that within a 30-day period after saying, yes, there are all these problems. They kind of reversed themselves, not on the harms, but on their conclusion. They said, you know what, despite all of that, we are going to deregulate it, which means approve it without any conditions whatsoever. We have never known what happened in those mysterious 30 days. They have now withheld that information from CFS and from the public for now almost 2 years. We finally have litigated to force that information out. And I think there's a very good reason, I am sure, why they have been hiding that information, because I am sure that we are going to see that it was both corporate and White House influence having nothing to do with the science that pushed this harmful crop through. That is a scandal. And when an agency comes out and it does admit that it's going to have all these harms, and then suddenly 30 days later we see this turnaround, it's a tragic situation because, as you point out, alfalfa was grown almost entirely without herbicides. And to see 25 million more pounds of this herbicide being spread, and that means pollution of our food, pollution of dairies, pollution of water, pollution of air, destruction of endangered species, destruction of the soil, all those things that go with it. And we're continuing to litigate on this, and we're certainly going to find out. We will get to the bottom of this, and when we do, the American public will know about, what happened. You pointed out something very important, John, which is that sometimes we forget, and this goes back to the corn question as well, how much of our farmland is actually devoted to these fairly useless crops. Not alfalfa so much, but corn makes up about 30% of U.S. farmland. 30%. And if you add soy to that, you've got well over half of our farmland, about 53%, is used just to grow corn and soy. And about 98% of corn is used for cars and cattle and other animal factories. Shouldn't be there altogether. And about 97% of soy is used for these chicken factories that are horrible. and cruel, and the rest is used for fuel. So almost none of it is going to feed anybody, and almost all of it is genetically engineered. You know, it's about 97% of everything that's genetically engineered out there right now is corn and soy. So when you hear the biotech companies say they're curing world hunger, you know, you don't even know what to say, because 98% of your stuff's going to cars and cattle or chickens. They're either biofuels or they're going into these animal factories. Almost none of it's feeding anybody. And what does it say about American agriculture, where we're devoting this much of our arable land, not to food, not to diversity, not to the diverse food that we all need, but to these commodities, which really have nothing to do with feeding people, nothing to do with feeding people healthy food, nothing to do with increasing the health of ourselves and our communities. Well over 50% of our farmland are these commodities that are really just there for the profit of these corporations, including Monsanto and the biotech companies. You know, we need to begin to make a distinction when we talk about crops between crops for food and these commodity plants that are being used for fuel and for these animal factories. And really, we need to reimagine our entire agriculture based on feeding people healthy food and not making profits for these giant agribusiness and agrochemical companies.
Vandana Shiva talks about health per acre as a criteria by which you would assess the viability and the value of agriculture. By that standard, these commodity crops are appallingly pathetic.
Yeah, they're almost zero, as far as their real contribution to a helpful food system. You know, it's not hard. You know, people often say to me, and John and Ocean, you must get this as well. They say, no, 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 you talk about this new food future and a food revolution. You know, what do you mean? It sounds complicated, but it really isn't. You know, when you think of the essentials, what do you need to grow a healthy crop, a healthy plant? Well, you need soil. You need seed. You need water. You need sun. You got to have farmers. And you got to have pollinators. And if you look at the current industrial system, it has devastated our topsoil. We all know the facts. We're losing our topsoil 10 to 15 times faster than it can replace itself. And that's true globally. As both of you know so well, we've lost about 93% of our fruit and vegetable varieties, all that beautiful diversity. Not only do we lose the beauty of all that diversity, but also the taste and also the vitamins and the health that that diversity provides us. So we're looking at almost a total 75% diversity loss. So soil is devastated by the current food system. Seed is being devastated, the diversity of seed through these monocultures. We don't need to even talk about what's going on with groundwater, the tremendous loss of groundwater. We're having 500-year droughts in California. You know, we've lost a huge amount of the Gala aquifer. I mean, we're really in trouble with our water, and we're already having states sue each other. You know, the sun, which used to be our friend, optimal temperatures for photosynthesis is 77 degrees. With global climate destabilization, you know, we're seeing that rise and rise. At 104 degrees, you know, it stops altogether. In my lifetime, we lost over 10 million farmers. Less than 1% now of Americans are farmers. Lost over 5 million farms in my lifetime. And we've just sued the EPA on a couple different things to try and stop them from okaying these neonicotinoid pesticides that are destroying the bees and the pollinators. So if you look at the current system, what it's doing to our soil, our seed, our water, the sun, the farmers, the pollinators, these basics, really basic stuff, it's terribly destructive. And so a food revolution, a food system means a regenerative agriculture that restores the soil at the level soil restores itself, that restores the beautiful and great diversity of our seed, that restores, lets water restore itself in the great water cycle of the earth, that turns the sun back into a friend and not into the enemy that we turned it through destabilization, have healthy farms and farm communities, and have pollinators that are thriving. I mean, that's the food revolution. It's very simple. So, you know, a food revolution is really about the basics. It's just restoring those basics. And we have to sort of understand, I think, that none of these parts of nature have ever read Adam Smith. They don't know about the market. You know, topsoil doesn't know it needs to reproduce itself according to human demand. Water doesn't know that the cycle should be quickened because humans need more water. You know, they're not going to respond to human demand. We need to have a food system that respects these patterns of nature, and I call it a regenerative agriculture that is calibrated to the rhythms and the regeneration of nature and not the supply and demand of these commodity crops that we just talked about.
I hear you talking about a regenerative agriculture and contrasting it to what you're describing, and I would almost call it a predatory agriculture. that we've had and developed. It's so based in agrochemicals. And one of the victims, as you mentioned, are the bees and the other pollinators. We need them. Many of our fruits, many of our vegetables, our nuts, they're reliant upon pollinators for production. Really, the vast majority of flowering plants would be unable to reproduce or to provide food without bees and other pollinators. Not that long ago, 10 years ago, beekeepers would lose about 5% of their bees each year. That was the natural cycle. But their annual losses began to rapidly increase in maybe 2005 with the advent of a phenomena that's now known as colony collapse disorder. Last year, more than 50% of the hives that are needed to pollinate many of the nation's vegetables and fruits and nuts were wiped out. Andy, how many dead bees is it going to take before the EPA acts?
Well, we've already had billions. What's happened here is another scandal, I'm afraid. What we have is an agency, the EPA, that has been listening to the company Bayer and a couple of other companies and not, I don't think it even has understood the catastrophe that it has led to. I mean, we are looking at bee losses of 40%, 50%. We've talked to beekeepers who have lost 100%. And as you point out, John, so correctly, something around 75% of our food crops would be unable to reproduce without these pollinators. And I'm not sure we're taught enough about this in school, of how dependent we are on these pollinators. And they've allowed a new group of pesticides based on nicotine, actually, you know, the short is neonics, these nicotinoidal pesticides, to be used. They soak the seeds in these pesticides, and they did zero testing. They sort of just took the industry's word for it. Industry, Bayer said, hey, we'll get you the test later to show they're safe. So they got a conditional approval and wrote on that conditional approval for over a decade with no science, zero science. I'm not kidding. And, of course, that allowed a huge amount of these pesticides to be sold, to be used in a vast majority of the corn crop, you know, that's out there and other crops as well. And that has been disastrous because this is a neurotoxin, and it's had this effect on bees where they don't necessarily die in the hives, but they just don't come back. Neurologically, this destroys them, and we're seeing an exponential problem. I mean, there's already been some problems, we know that, with bee colonies, but the neonicotinoidal pesticides and the fact that they were never tested. Now the EPA says, oh, we're going to start doing testing. We've litigated. We've sued them to do this testing. We've sued them to take these off the market, as they have been taken off the market for 2 years on a moratorium in Europe, sensible over there, not here, to try and save their bees. It is just remarkable that the EPA, which is often one of the best of our agencies, to be frank, nevertheless, even the EPA put the interest of a couple of corporations, and by the way, even foreign corporations, in front of the survival of our pollinators, which we all depend on for survival. Really a scandal. Again, we've litigated now numerous causes of action. We brought in a number of other organizations. There's some wonderful other organizations that are fighting this at other levels, you know, Beyond Pesticide, Pesticide Action Network. People have been on this. You know, we work with that larger coalition. But this is a critical fight, and it's a critical fight for human survival. It's a critical fight for our food security, you know, that we all need. It's very important. If you get on our website, centerforfoodsafety.org, or Beyond Pesticides or Pesticide Action Network or other groups, you know, you'll find plenty of spaces where you can personally, everybody listening, can contact the EPA and say, stop. We need to stop the use of these pesticides. They need to stop. We don't have time. You know, we're about to hit a cliff. This is not some kind of a slow, thoughtful, you know, we need to test a million times. No, we know what's going on. We've seen the exponential loss. We've seen with the sensible policy that's taking place in Europe. Now is the time to do a moratorium on these neonics, certainly until we find out much, much more about their interaction with bee colony collapses. And by the way, these are neurotoxins, so they don't just affect the bees. There's plenty of good science out there that shows that they affect mammals as well, and that could be us as well. And we just released a report, which you can get on our website, that shows that they don't even really work. So the one thing we know is that they kill the bees, but they don't even really work very well as pesticides. We did a review of dozens and dozens of studies, the first ever that's done this, a peer-reviewed scientific review, and it shows that these neonicotinoids not only kill the bees, but they don't really kill the pests they're supposed to kill. So sort of a tragic, ironic twist there. So you can check out that study.
I'm thinking about how often the FDA will say that it's up to the companies to determine the safety of any GE food. Right now, the FDA is on the verge of approving a genetically engineered salmon that has been engineered by the Aqua Bounty Company, even though the company data do indicate that it exhibits increased allergenicity. And also, many conventional supermarket chains, Safeway and Kroger and others, have said they won't sell it, even if the FDA approves it. The Alaskan Senator, Lisa Murkowski, has said that if genetically engineered salmon were to escape into the wild, that could threaten the entire wild salmon industry. And what I want to ask you, Andy, is what's your view of the FDA's actions so far regarding it?
Well, you know, this is a puzzle. I mean, here you have a product, this genetically engineered salmon. By the way, here's the whole idea. They wanted to take a salmon and make it a lot bigger, grow faster, basically profit margin, right? Nature isn't efficient enough for these companies. They want to try and massively increase the growth in the time of growth of these salmon so they don't have to feed them as much and they can sell them sooner. They first tried human growth genes. That's right, they really did. Then cattle growth genes. And then when they figured that would not pass the yuck factor of most people, then they went on and now they have a gene from another fish and another salmon. So, but the whole idea is to try and get these salmon to grow faster. The problem is that while they've achieved some of that, there's all sorts of other problems with these salmon. They have cranial abnormalities. You know, they have a number of other physiological changes. You know, we still don't know all of them because we haven't received all the information that we really do, but we know there's less omega-3. We know a lot that's happening physiologically. These animals were not meant to have these foreign genes in them that forced them into this unnatural growth. So why is the FDA even thinking about it? Well, it's been pending for 12 years. Center for Safety, we filed 7 different legal actions to stop the salmon. And if they were to go ahead and approve it, we will, of course, litigate immediately. There's a huge coalition of groups now, nationally and internationally, that are fighting this. Well over 1.5 million people have told the FDA, officially commented, the FDA saying, do not approve the salmon. So why they're still thinking of it, I do not know. And it is very important, John, what you brought up, which is researchers, numerous actually, independent university researchers, have written peer-reviewed papers that show that fish like this that have been genetically engineered to have greater size often have an advantage in mating. Particularly the female salmon, they prefer the larger fish. So you're going to get much more reproduction out of the genetically engineered variety than you would the natural variety. And what makes that so hideous and insidious is the fact that because of these abnormalities I talked about before, there's 1/3 greater death rate in the offspring. So this is kind of like Darwin on his head. Here you have a reproductive advantage for these genetically engineered fish, so they're going to have a lot more offspring, but there's going to be 1/3 greater mortality. And looking at a number of these studies, scientists have said that within about 30 generations, because of the terrible arithmetic of this 1/3 greater mortality in the offspring, you could have complete extinction of native species in about 30 years. One study I saw said that if only 60 of these genetically engineered fish were allowed to be escaped, they could actually make a population of 60,000 extinct in 30 generations because of this. So think of all the effort that so many wonderful organizations have made to protect our salmon, to try and preserve our salmon and a number of other of our fish species. And then imagine this terrible arithmetic. And what makes it always so scary for me is that once they're out, you know, once you would have a aquaculture situation where these genetically engineered salmon would escape into a river and then into the ocean, you can't call them back. There's no way you can recall them. You can say, oh, oops, sorry, jeez, we need those back. That could be terrible. No, they're out there. You cannot recall them. That terrible arithmetic will begin. And that road to extinction would be unstoppable. So if there was ever any decision that any agency had to make that should be based on the precautionary principle, this would be it. So, you know, we've stopped them for 12 years from this hopeless, ridiculous product, which, of course, I would not eat. I would not eat A because you don't want less omega. You have no idea what the other physiological problems that these bizarre genetic engineering has done to this poor creature. And number two, ethically. I mean, this is, you know, ethically, this isn't just environmental crisis and an ethical crisis. Why would we ever want to buy into a process that not only was cruel to the animal involved, but also could involve making one of the most prized species of our fish extinct?
Well, we appreciate your efforts to stop it. Consumer demand for non-genetically engineered foods is increasing across the board. Whole Foods says that when a product is labeled non-GMO in their stores, sales of that product immediately go up 15 or 20%. Earlier this year, the big cereal company Post Foods announced that their original Grape Nut cereal would henceforth be made without any genetically engineered ingredients, and the coveted non-GMO Project seal will appear on the front of boxes of Grape Nut's original to confirm that this has been independently verified. And their announcement followed just days after General Mills announced it had reformulated original Cheerios to remove GMOs. Meanwhile, Monsanto and its allies are trying to push legislation through Congress that would make it impossible for any state to require labeling of genetically engineered foods. It's quite a battle that's going on. What do you think we're going to see in the coming years?
Well, it's not a matter of if we're going to get labeling of genetically engineered foods. It's a matter of when. We will get it. They're fighting a losing battle in Washington, D.C. They have for months been trying to get somebody in Congress to introduce a bill that would preempt any state from having labeling. And we do a lot of other nasty things, too. But it's essentially saying to each state, you do not have the right to choose. To the voters in Connecticut and in Maine, whose representatives have already passed labeling legislation, it would reverse that. To the legislature of Alaska, which has labeling for all genetically engineered fish and genetically engineered fish products, it would reverse that. So literally, it would go in and usurp the will of the people. I testified, several months ago in New York State in favor of their state labeling bill there. And I was asked by a representative, he said, I'm confused. He said, why is the industry fighting labeling so hard? I mean, don't they think genetic engineering is okay? I mean, why are they fighting it so hard? And I said, it's really simple. In 30 years, these companies have failed to produce a single genetically engineered food that gives any advantage to the public at all, that provides any benefit at all. No lower cost, no more nutrition, no less fat, no less calories, no better taste, no nothing. They have done nothing. What they have been able to do is sell farmers, particularly large farmers, on these seeds because they can aerial spray their crops with these deadly toxic herbicides instead of the careful use they would otherwise, because these herbicides would kill the crops otherwise. So these herbicide-tolerant crops do allow for massive spraying. So, as you mentioned before, but now just with corn and soy, 115 million more pounds of this herbicide are poured on our crops every year because of this. And that's money in Monsanto's pocket. That's money that's being spent for their seeds and for 115 million more pounds of their Roundup. You know, so Monsanto comes out really well, except now, of course, they've created these weeds that are resistant, right? About 50% of American farmland now has weeds that you cannot kill with Roundup. And that's why we're getting... We can talk about these 2,4-D in these dicamba crops. But the real reason why they want to fight labeling is because it would lose in the marketplace. If you had to say, yes, made with genetic engineering, it tells the public there's additional risk and no benefit. Well, what rational consumer is going to see two products, one that says, yes, made with GMOs or with genetic engineering, and the other not, and buy the GMOs, same price, no benefit, only added risk. So that's why they're so against absolutely fighting to the last breath against labeling, because it exposes that this entire technology has been a massive market failure. You cannot expect to compete in any marketplace in America, any businessman knows this, unless you are providing some advantage to a consumer. To provide no advantage and only risk and hope to survive in the marketplace ain't gonna happen. And that's why they're so afraid of labeling. It's their dirty little secret they almost never talk about, and too few people talk about, which is they have completely failed this technology to provide any advantage to consumers, and labeling exposes that and would be a disaster for them in the marketplace. And that is why you don't see any GMOs for sale in Europe and around the world, because there is good labeling. Because once there is labeling, the educated consumer goes, aha, I won't buy that product, no benefit, only risk. And that's what they're afraid of.
Sometimes people will say, well, this is science, so therefore it's advance, it's progress, and we shouldn't stand in the way of it. And, you know, how do we know that these people aren't really doing something great? And sometimes I think, well, there's 64 nations, including all of the European community, that have banned it and are requiring labeling of it. And are they all Luddites? I mean, are they all anti-science? Or is it more the case that our government has become dominated by corporate interests?
Yeah, don't get me started, John, on the science thing, because, you know, we have been litigating on this. And I'm not just talking about Center for Food Safety. I'm very proud of what we've done, but numerous other organizations as well with us and our allies. We have stopped genetically engineered tomatoes. We have stopped genetically engineered potatoes. We have stopped genetically engineered wheat from being commercialized. We have stopped genetically engineered rice from being commercialized. For 8 years, we blocked genetically engineered alfalfa. We forced, through labeling, Monsanto to give up its flagship product, BGH. We have stopped genetically engineered bentgrass from being commercialized. We have for 12 years stopped genetically engineered salmon. And we haven't done this through no science. We haven't done this because we've gone into court and we've said to the court, our science is better than the government science. Our science is better with the corporation science. You can't let this out there. And we have won time and time and time again. And, you know, there's another thing that bothers me about the science, because many of the arguments we used were, wait a minute, if we continue to use this massive dosing of herbicides, these weed killers like Roundup, the weeds will become resistant. This is simple adaption. This is simple microevolution. This is grade 5 science, elementary school science, adaption. And the companies who claim to be scientific denied it. They said, oh, no, that won't happen. That won't happen. But of course it was going to happen. Of course, without any question, weeds were going to become resistant, and now, as I said, they have. And almost 50% of all American farmland, in some of these cotton areas where they've been using, you know, Roundup Ready cotton, you're talking about pigweed, which has the, you know, the size and consistency of a baseball bat and grows so closely together you can't knock it over with a combine. And this is a real crisis. And so now they're saying, okay, you were right, sorry, but now we want to have corn and soy and cotton that is resistant to 2,4-D. So we want to put 400 or 500 million more pounds of 2,4-D. It's the only way we can kill these weeds. Yeah, we know it was an element of Agent Orange. We know it's associated with a number of different diseases, from Parkinson's to various cancers. Yeah, we know that. But it's the only way now we can kill the various super weeds we caused. And that's Dow Chemical that's doing that. And it's up for approval right now at the USDA. And then Monsanto, not to be outdone, they're saying, no, we know Roundup won't work anymore. Soon 2,4-D won't work anymore. We want to stack all that with dicamba, which is one of the worst herbicides known to man. So they're going to have corn, soy, and probably cotton that is resistant to dicamba. According to Dave Morton at Penn State, you're going to see 800 million more pounds, 800 million more pounds of Roundup, 2,4-D, and dicamba sprayed on our corn, soy, and cotton crops. And remember, we said that's over 53% of our farmland in the next few years, unless we stop this. Unless we stop it. You know, they've gotten a million signatures saying don't do the 2,4-D, don't do the dicamba, but it's a really critical juncture. And just by comparison, it's our estimate that because of all the great work we have all done through the continuing growth of organic in this country, we are saving ourselves 40 to 50 million pounds of pesticides from being used, because they're not allowed to be used in organic. They aren't being used, which is great. But now we're talking about 800 million more pounds of toxic pesticides being used because of these new genetically engineered crops. Compare that to what we've gained through organic, and you see, if we allow this new generation of herbicide-tolerant crops, these pesticide-promoting crops, which is what we call them, pesticide-promoting crops, to get out there, it will completely wipe out all of the advantages that we've done through organic over the years. It's really a critical moment in the future of food in the 21st century, is not allowing this next generation of Dow's 2,4-D and Monsanto's dicamba to come on the market. It's critical, critical. It's a really historic, dramatic moment where we need to stop that over the next year and 2 years to make sure that this does not happen, because it's planned obsolescence. Within 10 or 12 years, weeds will become resistant to 2,4-D and dicamba, and we don't have any more herbicides. The reason they're going back to Agent Orange and going back to dicamba is because we don't have any new ones. It's like antibiotics. They're creating a real nightmare for the future of millions and millions of acres choked with weeds. We won't know how to get rid of them. And so this is the time now to go to, you know, organic, integrated, you know, weed management. Dave Mortensen, Rodale Institute, People have done great research on this. It's very doable. And that's the road you need to take, not go further down this terrible toxic track of these herbicide-tolerant, pesticide-promoting crops.
We clearly are at a critical moment in history. And Andy, you've been working for a safe and healthy food supply for a long time. As you reflect on this particular moment in history, what would you have us remember? What is important for us to keep in mind as we go forward?
Well, I mean, I think that we have to have a vision, and we have to realize that many of us have fought for organic for a very long time. And I think we need to have the courage to say that organic should be the floor of all American agriculture, not just a niche market. It is growing, but it needs to be the floor of all of our agriculture. And it needs to be an agriculture, as you and I have said before, that actually grows food and not commodity crops for the big companies. Actually diverse, healthy, non-toxic food. But that's just the floor. It's not the ceiling. Organic isn't the ceiling. The future of food, the house of the future of food that we want to build above that is food that is organic and local. Organic and appropriate scale. And this is very important, I know, to us. And humane. Right? Organic and humane. Organic and socially just, and organic and biodiverse. So we have to have local and appropriate scale. My God, we have to have humane. Each of us every day must think about really the modern crime of what's going on with 10 billion animals every year. What's going on in those animal factories is a modern crime. It really is. Social justice, we need that, obviously. And biodiversity, we need to restore that biodiversity that this system has cost us. And that, of course, will all help address climate destabilization. Local, obviously, less carbon use, biodiversity, better soils, better carbon sink for our soils, and on and on. So that's the house. That's the future of vision of food I would like to think about. Organic and beyond. Organic and local. Organic and appropriate scale. Organic and humane. Organic and socially just so that everyone is paid right and treated correctly, all those farmers working on our farms and all the farmers in the farm communities. And, of course, biodiversity. So that's sort of, you know, the organic and beyond vision that I think we all need to fight for. You know, it's so exciting. It's so great to be working this movement and the food revolution work you're doing, because this is something people can do about every day. You know, it's hard to stop an unwise war. It's heartbreaking, but it's difficult. How do you stop it? How do you change your energy grid? You know, how do you make sure there's not nuclear power being used or some other coal? It's really hard. It's really hard to do that. But in this one huge area of our economy, of our lives, of our relationship with the environment, and eating and drinking is the most intimate relationship we do have with the environment. In this one area we have control, we can start doing something in the next hour. Do not ever eat industrial meat. If you get on our website, we have a very good guide that can help you avoid GMOs completely when you buy food. Just get on our website. It's right there, the guide. Very easy to use. Even I understand it. I can use it, you know. We can make choices every day to buy local. Certainly, of course, always to go organic. And we need to make that more accessible and affordable. But, you know, we're not mere consumers. You, me, all of us listening, we're not mere consumers. You know, I hate that word. You know, fires consume. You know, they used to call tuberculosis consumption because it ate the bodies of the poor victims of that disease. We're not consumers. We're creators. Every day, and maybe we won't make the right decision one day. That's okay. None of us are perfect. We're all trying. We're all trying to go in that direction. But we need to be conscious every day that we are creators of a new food future. We're either going to create that future or we're going to continue to create that totally this destructive, hopeless, you know, zombie of an industrial agricultural system that's already on its last legs. Or we can create that new food, organic and beyond food future. That's the vision we all of us have to have in our mind as we proceed with every food decision we make, the food we grow, the food we eat, the food we feed our children, the food we buy. That is sort of the vision I would like to share. And I'd like to say, you know, it's not only about our health, which is really critically important, of course, and it's not just the health of the environment, which is also critically important, but it's also a profoundly moral choice. It's a choice about those animals. It's a choice about the farm communities that are being devastated. It's about the poisons that are being put into our fields, into our water, destroying the species that live in our country. I mean, it's a moral choice, too. To defend that which we believe in. So it's good for our health, it's good for the environment, but it's also the right moral choice to be creators of that new food future.
Andy, as I listen to you and as I reflect on your life work and all that the Center for Food Safety has done, I think that that there's some part of just about every man that wants to be a warrior. I don't mean that we need more violent or misogynist men, and we certainly don't need more wars against life, but we do need warriors for the earth, warriors of the heart. What we do need are men who fight for the health and the well-being of the whole earth community. And Andy, you have long been one of our foremost leaders in the fight to protect the environment and public health from the threats of chemical pollution and industrial agriculture. You have successfully challenged federal agencies time and time again, along with your colleagues at the Center for Food Safety, played a vital role in launching crucial legal challenges against the planting of genetically engineered crops. On behalf of myself, of Ocean, really on behalf of the whole Earth community, certainly the entire Food Revolution Network, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your years of tireless, tenacious service, your brilliance, and your wisdom, and your example as a man of very deep courage. It's been, as always, a pleasure and a privilege to talk with you today.
You know, John, thank you so much for those two kind words. Abraham Lincoln once said that the greatest warriors are lovers, because when you love something, you will fight for it. If you love a species, you'll fight to make sure that species is protected. So you don't fight for fighting's sake, you fight to protect that, you know, which you love. So, and I know that is what the food revolution is all about, what you and Ocean are all about, and I deeply appreciate that. It'll make us all the best warriors. The best warriors are the lovers, I promise you.
That's so beautiful. We've been talking here with public interest attorney and Center for Food Safety founder Andrew Kimbrell. Andy, you are a passionate warrior, a lover of life. You are eloquent, and you're a trusted advocate for our lives and for our planet. I am so glad that the Food Revolution Network has had the privilege of collaborating with you in the Center for Food Safety in the last year on many projects, and that we are your partner and ally every step of the way in the food revolution. It's been an honor to share this time with you, and we thank you on behalf of all of our listeners and all of life.
Ocean, thank you so much, and for all the great work you're doing. Bless you.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get CDs, members-only courses, and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. Now we have some pre-recorded messages from some of the people whose lives have been touched by the food revolution. One of the participants in a past food revolution summit was Cherise Scally, age 48, from Spring, Texas. This is Cherise's story in her own words.
Hello, my name is Cherise Scally, and I want to share my food revolution story. I am 48 years old, and after adopting a whole food lifestyle in 2011, I have been diabetes-free for almost 3 years. I attended school to get certifications in nutrition and health coaching so that I could help others do what I have done. I suffered from type 2 diabetes for almost 12 years as a result of gestational diabetes that took the life of my preterm daughter in November 99 at 26 weeks gestation. It almost took my life, too. After I discovered the power of raw whole foods and adopted a veganish lifestyle, my life changed almost overnight. My diabetes was gone, I was healthy, in shape, down 40 pounds, and I haven't looked back. The Food Revolution Summit has been an important part of my continuing journey. It reinforces what I learned on my journey to reverse my diabetes, and it gives me the tools to help my clients. I value the information that the summit has to offer, and I share it with everyone who will listen.
In December 2011, I became a grandmother. Thanks to being diabetes-free, I have a wonderful life ahead of me, and I am enjoying every moment of it. I love to share my story, and I hope it will inspire others to do what I have done and know that it's possible to be diabetes-free. I wish you the best on your journey.
To express your opinions on what you've been hearing, and to find out what other people are saying, we'd like to invite you to post and engage in the comments section at the bottom of our broadcasts page. You'll have to make sure to refresh the page so you can see the most recent comments. Our next presentation will be an interview with internationally acclaimed food scientist, Dr. Michael Hansen. It will start at the top of the hour, followed an hour later by Ken Cook. Until then, here's some music from our friend, Bruce Beckvar.